wills the future of the American path, which I've suggested may, or I've got another one here, may or may not be helpful if any of you are interested in following this up for discussion back in your hometowns. He has several good specific discussion topics for us, and that's, I've mimeographed one, you remember, on Monday and on this one today, and you'll see that they are very provocative. And he also has several other kinds of exercises which are very good. It isn't just a matter of having a teacher coming in and talking, you know, for an hour or so, but all of these are very carefully worked up with the idea of taking specific examples and then building on those so that we can reach some sort of consensus, even though we may disagree, as to what, you know, various goals, or I should say various values in American life, like mission, as we talked about, and then freedom yesterday and today, and inequality, you know, really mean, and whether or not our traditional understanding of these values, you know, mean anything of at all, mean anything for the future. Because to go right into equality, since it's, you know, this is a bicentennial year, and a fellow yesterday suggested this too, that there would be an interesting bicentennial discussion group session, I think it would. In our Declaration of Independence, which we celebrate this year, we have the idea that all men are created equal. And this is something all Americans, you know, like most Americans, like to believe, that this is really important for them. And yet, as I think Brill shows, there has been no area in all of American life where there has been less fulfillment of the promise of this particular value than in the whole field of equality. Because what Americans meant by equality, as we talked about a little bit, you remember yesterday, was equality for adult white males for a long period in American history. And even today, obviously, there is an enormous distance, you know, to be traveled or to be made up, I should say, in that area. So equality is something that, you know, we write, just like we were saying yesterday, we like the government to provide services for us so long as we don't have to pay for them. And when they start to pay for them, then we start talking about limitations on our freedom. And today, when certain new ideas and certain new demands from various groups are made on us, which seem to threaten equality, then we make a different stand about equality when it comes down to, you know, specific examples. And this is why I would like to talk about it on a specific case-by-case study rather than talk about it more or less in the abstract. Let me start by reading, I might have typed this out in mimeographed, but it'll work just as well here if I can talk about it in the fire. A case study for us to think about, and then if this makes any, you know, sense for us to discuss with the idea of equality, I think, you know, it might be helpful to pursue this for some time. And this is a hypothetical situation that Earl Brill writes down for us. He said, it's what he called, you know, role playing. He said, you are an American Indian, the father of an 11-year-old boy who is attending government school on your reservation. Your tribe lives in poverty and squalor, and you harbor few hopes for the future. Your son has just been offered a full scholarship to attend a leading boarding school in New England. The grant will cover tuition, room, and board for his entire school year. You are trying to make up your mind what to do. What would you do? This, I know that you can't have an instant answer there. I just like to sort of throw things out, and I'll talk around it for a while. But here is a very good case study of what we mean by equality in America and some of the problems that we face, you know, not in 1776, but in 1975 and 1976, over the whole issue of equality. Just for fun, playing roles here for a minute, if you were a father of a talented, precocious son who had a chance to get off the reservation and get the best possible, you know, education that American schools can offer, in, let's say, a private school in New England, what would you do?
I think I'd first decide whether the kid could stand the possible prejudice against him, if he might be the only Indian in the whole school, or at least in his whole family class, let's say.
Okay.
A certain type of kid can take it, another type of kid.
How would, you know, you, what would you look for, you know, for in the son, by way of indications?
That's an outgoing.
Outgoing kind of personality?
We have a 12-year-old son who doesn't fit that.
Oh, I see.
Usually, a lot of times, very intelligent children have a tendency to be kind of retiring. Yeah. I mean, even on this very low educational level of the reservation, it's go- going to be pretty obvious he's smarter than the rest of the kids, and there's a tendency that he could be left out. And if he gets into a completely different kind of a social environment, it might break him. The problem, you know, would be for the father. Now, does he want his child to go to this New England boarding school and become, you know, completely Americanized, which is the only thing that can happen to him here, or should he keep him on the reservation, you know, in this lousy situation, and hope that the kid somehow, through intelligence, will still maintain the culture of the people? I know a lot of Indians in Wisconsin, this is a very, it's great to send them out to get education, down in Milwaukee or someplace, but it's the same thing, then they're lost. You know, they lose their this cultural background.
Okay, but, in America, just to keep it going here, in America, the ideal has been, for self-improvement, for getting a good education, for getting out from underneath, the burden of oppression and so on. And the way to do this is primarily, first of all, is through education.
Well, this is a great American white dream. This is a dream that my forefathers came over with, that the pilgrims came, but it's purely a white thing. It's not a black thing it's never been open to them.
Okay. Yeah.
I taught on the Menominee Indian Reservation for 2.5 years.
Good, I'd like to hear it, son.
And I wouldn't take anything in the world for the experience. And I found that the children are very, very closely knit to their parents. The father wants to teach his son just what he does, hunting and fishing and thinking like that. And the mother wants to teach the homework and growing corn and all things like that. And it is very, very difficult for them to work with their children. Many of them are very against them coming to the government school or to the Catholic school, which was right across the valley. And often the children would run home, their children would their parents would conceal them and would go out with them.
What's that
effect? And I feel that the parental closeness to the children would be a big factor in them not wanting to let them go. And when I was 10 years old, we had a minister's wife that was tremendously interested in Indians. And our church had a school at what's one of the places where Luther was?
Wittenberg,
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, all right. Yeah. Luther wasn't in Wittenberg.
No,
Wisconsin,
but he was in Wittenberg.
Right. Germany, right.
Berlin, Wisconsin.
I had a girl, Mary Storm, that we sold for. We made everything for her that we had ourselves. I made curtains. I was in this until I was 14, until I was high school. And we made a bed for her, embroidered bed. We did all kinds of things. We had a sale at the bazaar table, and about every other Saturday we'd have sell pies or cake. We got as much as $5 for a pie because it was working for the Indians. And I went and met Mrs. Storm. This girl's name was Mary Storm, and she had one brother. Mary had one brother, and he was very talented. Making snow figures. Mm-hmm. He made a police dog that almost talked, bark. And all these different things. And he got a scholarship to Chicago to further his artwork. And they wouldn't let him go because Mary got the flu and died. Mm-hmm. And their children are so tremendously important to them. I don't know if that's true in some of the other minority groups, but I think it's not always true in homes.
Well, I think we had to be teaching a boarding school.
Yes.
So they were supposed to stay there
they lived there.
And then stay home. Well, I think what one of the things we're pro-saying is We tried to, when we were in there educating, we just make their cultural pulling away from home and sort of put them in our, try to back them into our culture totally and to lose their own culture. So they got stuck, you know, caught in two worlds. And we were very kind to that. That kind of thing. They wanted, if they wanted education, they had to go it our way.
Yes, I can speak a little on that too. The parents said, your education is okay, but we don't need it. But we don't need it because we lose our children to you. And they, who do they have when they get out of school? They just don't fit back into the home and into the reservation life. That was their pitch.
You, all right. Just to look at it from another perspective, then might it not be possible that you would be losing, if you didn't, you know, offer an education for somebody who has a close family situation like this, you would be losing a potential creative kind of person who might be able to learn, for instance, medicine or engineering or in art, for instance, and might be able to enrich the life. Aren't you just sort of saying, banishing them permanently to, you know, oblivion by keeping them on the reservation?
We had Indian teachers there.
Yeah.
And they were very good. Ruth, Alice Hampton was the beginners.
Mm-hmm.
She and I became very, very close friends. But she died from heart trouble some years later.
Yeah.
And she had to leave too. She had to get her education away from the...
She was a Choctaw Indian from Oklahoma.
Shouldn't you have, you know, shouldn't people in this situation, the American Indians, have the right to choose for themselves if they want to stay on the reservation?
Well, you're talking about a child here.
Oh yeah, 11-year-old, that's true.
But I know now, in Menasha, we have, I know very well because they went to school and grew up with them, who have rejected, got good education, got excellent jobs, you know, and they rejected the Indian way of life completely. They won't go near that reservation. They'll go around by 100 miles.
Yeah, we run across that same situation.
And we had a vice president, Mr. Curtis, who was an Indian.
Mm-hmm. For goodness sake, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I was going to say, as far as getting back to whether the 11-year-old child should be sent out, I would think that, again, the father isn't going to look at it from a literary standpoint, or from a standpoint of anything but himself, a selfish standpoint, I suspect. I would say that probably the child is not going to help, basically because of the fact that he's afraid of the outside world, period. They don't want to step a foot outside of the reservation, because from that point on, it's an unknown.
How many of us would like to send our 11-year-old kids away to the East Coast to...
Excuse me, Lois is going to... Go ahead, Lois.
I would say, how many of us would like to send our 11-year-old children away from home to the East Coast to get an education? I think we kind of worry about that itself.
How many of you would like to be told you had to send your 11-year-old child away?
He was given a choice, the way I understand.
Yeah, there's a choice, yeah.
Mm-hmm, there's a choice.
I'm probably begging the question, but I think that actually on the reservation there should be enough educational facilities and facilities of good enough quality that this child could say, stay there, get a good education till he may be 16 or 17 or 18, and then can make his own decision as to whether he wants to go out or not. Of course, this is begging the question.
I think what you find, though, is that sometimes the reservation before them wasn't large.
Well, they are.
Every now and then, we've heard of some Native American who's gone on and returned to the reservation to the doctor, something like that. That's sort of the rare story.
Yeah, sure.
I agree, they ought to have.
This is the whole problem. Again, begging the question about this kid, but this there should be on the reservation excellent education.
But if the Indians don't want it?
This is
they're doing now, they are doing now up at in Kashina and Neopit up there, they have Indian schools by Indian teachers teaching Indian culture, even the language. They're taking the kids out and showing them how to build one of their little, temple's the wrong word, but a worship place where they can come and worship. And at the same time, though, they're getting a good basic education in math. You know, this math doesn't have any sex or anything, you know.
No.
And things sure. like that, you know, where they can,
yeah.
you know, and so, and at the same time, though, they're maintaining their culture, and by doing this, then later on, maybe the plans are that when they reach a certain point, you know, you stay what you are, and then they're going to plan to send them on maybe to the University of Wisconsin to try to set up scholarships down there where, well, some of them want to go into forestry. They have huge forests on the Menominee Reservation up there, or go into agriculture, and the whole point of this is to get them to come back, see? So they keep their culture and come back again.
Yeah, but you have to remember, one of the very interesting things is that they do not have the right to make the decisions that you and I make.
No.
The government, going into agriculture is a very lousy thing, because the government may decide to lease out the land to somebody at $1 a year for 99 years and has done this.
Well, maybe in other
places. Oh, yes, they have, if you look at the history.
No, not the Menominee, kind of at this reservation. And
but what, look at the brother's thing there.
But see, this was outside the reservation.
Yes, and
no, it was inside the reservation as far as what the Indians considered.
That'll be in the courts a long, long time.
Well, why did they use the land? Because the government decided to. But many of these decisions that government makes, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, they're saying, hey, let us make those decisions whether we want to use that land.
But our Indians decided to go back on the reservation status. They were free. They were a county.
They were a county. Made a county. Yeah.
They were a county, but they voted to go back to the reservation.
They didn't want to pay taxes.
Well, they couldn't make it.
They still do not have the right of self-determination, that risk of the DIA.
Oh, yes, they are.
Yeah, you see,
they a great deal.
Well, yeah. I don't want to get started on, you know, the factual.
Yeah. No, even when I was there, there were some educators that came. There were two or three women I was with that walked into my classroom, and they said, we're from the, well, let's call it Indian Rights Association. It wasn't that, but I don't know what it was. And they said, we want to see what is going on in the classroom. We want somebody to go to the board and work some problems. And we want somebody to read. We want somebody to sing, and we want them to sing. Well, these children wouldn't do one single thing for these people. And I did blame them.
Hmm. Okay. Were they Indians themselves? They came in as
no,
Indian race, they were white.
People.
Yeah, bleeding, yeah.
From Appleton and Green Bay.
We found that, on my own personal experience, that the Indians have been very unappreciative of anything that we've done for.
Why should they be?
And, well, the thing that hurts the worst, and again, this was federal money that was involved, but we built a destination center, as it's called, on the Menominee Reservation. Quite a beautiful setting, and a beautiful structure and so forth. And it included a natural history building for the Indians, and a place where they could come and display and sell their wares that they may make, rugs, anything that was crafted. That included a general store, which they had not, any store that were of any quality to speak of. And this building was about this, it's a complex. It's about 3 years old. You know, just through this summer, and I couldn't believe what it looked like.
Was that
the Menominee
Reservation?
Yes, at Kashina.
I would like to see what it looks like now, because they were given charge of managing the lumber industry, and they just didn't know how to do it.
No, that's the whole problem. It's just going to nothing.
Well, isn't it, you know, the white's responsibility, because you put them in situations where they don't have technical skills, and when it doesn't work out, then it's obviously it's simply further reinforcement of the white idea that they're inferior.
Right.
That you can't play, you know, the white man's rules, and therefore it just tends to reinforce the idea that, of withdrawing again from trying to do anything, you know, the way the white people want them to.
But they rebelled against this thing right from the time they
started. Was it involved in any of the planning?
No, probably not.
It was given to them.
That's the
point.
The story repeats and repeats and repeats. Look at what we did for somebody.
Right.
Beautiful housing project down in Kansas City for the poor, for the welfare. We did it for them, and look at those ungrateful. And social science knows, when you do something for somebody, don't expect them to be appreciative. You're getting a kick out of giving it. That's basically who's benefiting.
Right. But if we don't give it to them, they're just sitting there doing nothing.
Well,
I was
going
to
say,
they're maintaining the status quo, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure even if
they're... Don't they have a right to do it?
Is that a privilege that they ought to be guaranteed by the Constitution?
You see, their culture.
I mean, if they want to just hunt and fish, that's their business, you know.
The idea is, until it affects the welfare of the children.
Yeah. Well, that's their choice, their children.
Yeah, I know, but is that...
Well, the children are children.
Okay, but look.
By nature, they're...
Whose land does this belong to anyhow?
No argument there.
Yeah.
You know, we came in and we stripped them, we pushed them out of the laws of this land in the country, more or less.
The Menominee Reservation did not make that at all, and they were a living people.
That's a rich chunk
of
land.
Oh, well, they're trying to mark. Okay, but
they tried. They've been white men trying to get in there.
Beautiful.
But anyway, you know, and things like saying, well, now you can do arts and crafts. Again, that's reinforcing the racial stereotype. That the only thing the Indians can do, so far as the whites are concerned, is to produce little totem poles and bracelets.
Well, it's for, you know,
they had the standards.
You know
the
turtle?
Yeah. Well, that came to my mind. So they were educated. But the for sale is not their culture. They had a meaning to them.
I say this,
they
though.
They wanted to sell it to us.
That right now, though, as far as the Menominees, they have some tremendous tribal leadership. Adult Mary Dearin, well, there are several women and men on it. Ames, and they're very strong, and actually they're kind of going after each other now, but they're, mm-hmm. with the tribal leadership they have on both sides, both in Ames and the regular political governing body, I think you're going to see some real progress in this area, and they're going to do it themselves. I mean,
well,
do you recall about 8 years ago, not the Peace Corps, but
Vista, yeah.
Okay, you had a couple of girls who got fired from Vista, and why?
The Indians rejected them.
No. The Indians accepted them, and these two gals were helping the Native Americans assert their rights.
Nice. Oh, that was up in the, what was that road?
Yeah, I remember that.
Reservation.
And they were pulled out of there.
Yeah, I remember.
Where was that?
That was in northern Wisconsin.
It was in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it was in, there's that big reservation of way up in northern Wisconsin.
Stockbridge,
period, huh?
No, Stockbridge doesn't have a reservation.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Wherever it was.
I think it
was. Wherever it was, the point of the whole thing is.
Chippewa, I think that
was. The point of the whole thing is that when the girls went in there, and it wasn't exactly what the government wanted, but young ladies who were in there were really trying to work something for the Native Americans, and they got fired.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's typical of the story of what happens when the Native Americans sort of start making some noise and making their wants known.
Well,
I would like to say this, and then I won't talk anymore today. A year ago, I think it would be 2 years ago, in the August issue of the National Geographic, there is an article about the Menominee Indians, how the government allowed them to go back to their status. Now they want to make their own decisions and everything, but they had been selling their land to for summer homes for people from Chicago and different places, and to get ready money.
What was that? That's that Long Lake development.
Legend Lake.
Oh, that's why they went back, because white people just move in, they were going to take over that whole reservation.
Sure.
And that is just a beautiful, beautiful
place. Oh,
piece
it's
of
a
land.
Beautiful place.
So, to come to back to the point, so we can look at it in a larger perspective here, I think what's very hard for white Americans to understand is that what the Native Americans mean by equality is an entirely different thing than we have. And obviously, much of the difficulty that we have in some of the stories here, I think, are illustrations of this, are we've attempted to, you know, wherever it suited our purposes, to make them equal by our, you know, white standards, whereas they simply want to be quality, you know, by their own standards, for instance, on private property. And private property, you know, is simply unimaginable for them, and yet it's one of the most basic, you know, values of ours that we hold on to and consider to be, you know, vital to our free enterprise system. And since we had more guns, I suppose, and we had more armies, and all the rest, we were able to win. But that doesn't mean that, you know, what we did was right simply because we had more ammunition.
That's happened all over the world, though, where people have come in, taken over the natives, they set up a courthouse and claimed the land.
Yeah, right.
You know? Mm-hmm.
But all I'm saying is that that doesn't make it right.
No, in Turkey.
It happens, oh, sure.
It's nothing new.
It goes way back to ancient history. Oh, sure. It's just, you know, tragic. And all I'm suggesting is that it means we have to live with different standards of what we mean by equality in this country, because what might be equality for us, or what should I say, opportunity, that's a better word here, for us to achieve, is not necessarily, you know, true for another culture, such as the Native Americans. And in our impatience to have everybody, you know, become like us, at least within our boundaries, you know, we've become very restless with this, and I think have really, you know, created this problem. I don't think there would have been any problem if, you know, from the beginning, if we had learned, like William Penn, to go into American history to coexist peacefully with the Indians. They never had difficulty there because Penn treated them as, you know, fully autonomous people and made arrangements, treaties, worked out everything in a very sensible, you know, calm way. And he did it out of his, you know, his religious faith, in which in the Quaker faces, you know, there's complete, instead of talking about equality, you know, if you know the Quaker, you know, arrangements, everybody is completely equal. They have absolutely no, you know, show at all. There's an elder who is pretty much sort of says when church is over and everything else, but even in such a thing as marriages, a Quaker couple marries each other. And there's no clergy person at all involved because they want complete equality. And they extended this to the Indians, and you know, it had you know, great results. But other places, you know, it worked very badly, and we're just now beginning to see some of the results of this. And I live in Minneapolis, which is the headquarters for AIM, and we have Dennis Banks and the Bella Courts and the others, and we had the Wounded Knee trial last year, and the government blew that one. I'm beginning to be convinced that the government wants to blow these cases, because I can't figure out any other reason why the prosecutors would be so bungling, other than, you know, calculated desire that they have to show, you know, politically, they have to show the population who wants justice against Dennis Banks or something, that they are prosecuting. But they don't really, I don't think they really want to win, because if they can say that they lost the case on a technicality, then they're off the hook. This is just my own personal feeling, because they handled the Wounded Knee case so bad that, you know, Fred Nichols, the judge from South Dakota, is not exactly, you know, a flaming radical, and yet he was so appalled by the prosecution's case against Wounded Knee, against AIM, now that he threw it out. So I suspect that in our going into our third century, we've just sort of started to look at the whole matter of equality of the different cultures, you know, in a way which would have, if we had done it two centuries ago, would have solved a great deal of, you know, grief. And I hope, you know, I grant you, I'll give you a story on the other side. I hope this persists, because there are still the stereotypes that exist. My daughter, when she was 13, went to Concordia French, Concordia Moorhead, the French language camp, near Cass Lake, and of course there are a lot of Indians. There's a big reservation, Cass Lake, where we get the wild rice and so on. And after 2 weeks, they went into town and did their laundry. The first time she'd ever seen a Native American, and they were all older teenagers, Native Americans. They're all Chippewa, and they're all dead drunk, just bombed out on a Saturday. She'd never seen a Native American before, and her first conclusion was, "Boy, those Indians just, you know, live up the old stereotype. Just take a couple of, you know, smells of the cork and, you know, all they you know, all they are is dissipated drunks." And that's all she saw. And they were wearing tight jeans and black motorcycle jackets, you know, and the long hippie hairdo and the whole business. And that would have, you know, if nothing else had happened in her education, that would be the stereotype that, you know, she would have carried away with this. And, you know, it's kind of tragic that we haven't made any more progress with those situations. I'm not saying that just because you're militant and tough talking like say Banks or Bellacourt, that makes you automatically right, because I think sometimes, you know, there are obviously you know, transgressions on both sides. I'm not saying that all, everything that the white population has done is wrong, and everything that the Indian population has done is right. But I think the burden of proof, you know, rests with, you know, the status quo, with the government and with us rather than with the Indians, because as Lois said, it was, you know, it's still their land. No matter how you know, want to look at it, it still belongs to them. And, you know, you have all the treaties in the world, and that doesn't really change the ownership with it. So that's my little speech anyway. But, you know, enormous patience and goodwill and time, because so many of these, you know, just in education, well, just give you one more example. I think the best place to start, obviously, is the young people. And some of the Indian people are quite right in pointing out the racial stereotypes in textbooks. Because in even the best textbooks, when they showed pictures of American Indians, it's always somebody scalping a white person. Now, it isn't anymore, but until about 5 years ago in the textbooks, on the elementary level, there was a Pequot's War, you know, with the tomahawk and all the gore and the blood, and that's the thing that, you know, they emphasized, rather than the way in which the Indian could live in harmony with nature, for instance. The Indian only took what he needed and could live in peace and harmony very, very nicely. And they never will find those Indians, you know, on the Pine Ridge Reservation, because Indians can, you know, blend into nature, and, you know, you're never going to find them unless some of their own people turn them in, because they simply know how to coexist. But now there is, you know, a whole different kind of appreciation. And could live in peace and harmony very, very nicely. And they never will find those Indians, you know, on the Pine Ridge Reservation, because Indians can, you know, blend into nature, and, you know, you're never going to find them unless some of their own people turn them in, because they simply know how to coexist. But now there is, you know, a whole different kind of appreciation. I think that has to start there, because I'm afraid some of us, myself included, are almost beyond, you know, recovery on some of these attitudes. But yes.
I think we can take a good suggestion from Turkey. Turkey has had, I was in the Middle East in 66, and Turkey has had over 100 invasions.
Mm-hmm.
That very, there's always been a remnant left. And some of them wish, demanded to have their own autonomy within the country, and Turkey let them do it.
Yeah.
I learned an awful lot.
But it depends on what kind of land, for instance, in America. That was all the problem. Did they give them the best land? Because it's true what Lois said. I know there are exceptions, but for instance, in Minnesota, they got the worst land. South Dakota, they got the worst land. You could go on.
There's one place,
Wyoming.
Beautiful valley in Montana, between Missoula and Carlton, Montana. And I couldn't believe it. So I said to the guy, you know, who was Montana, I said, how on earth did they ever give the Indians such a beautiful valley? He said, well, when they made it a reservation, they thought it was barren land.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, and that is
I've been all through that, too.
Yeah. You know, the other thing is, you look back, and when you first came into this country, the Native Americans helped the settlers to learn how to plant corn.
Right. Squanto, you know, was the first, that's one of my favorite little quips. Squanto was the first county agent. You know what a county agent is, yeah.
In turn, we taught them to drink booze.
Right.
They helped us survive the winter. And
we gave them BD.
Gave them guns.
They gave us tobacco.
Then we decided we didn't want them around, so they had some blankets, you know, nice benevolent gifts of blankets, which is what they did. They had some lights for their smallpox epidemic. And they used those blankets on the kids with the smallpox, and they gave them the Indians to exterminate them with the smallpox.
Yeah.
And this is, if you really look at it, the problem is on. on. Yes, we're going to kill all the Indians. We're, march them in the winter from Florida to the other side of the west, Mississippi. It's a horror story.
Yeah.
If there's room on the reservation, I think in this case study, it would be best for the boy to stay.
Okay.
Because with his qualities, his characteristics, his talent, hopefully that it would bring about something within his own work in the reservation, whether it be in a leadership capacity or in some special area. And it just smacks of trying to Americanize the Indians when we send them off to school somewhere, because it's already made, the point was already made that, that they do become Americanized, but they don't stay. A white culture.
But, yeah.
I was just going to say, in part of the problem, the education of the, the white American, the child, you mentioned the books used to read the Tommy Hawk and so forth, but I think now children, my little girl just finished kindergarten, and she didn't have a single stereotype about a Indian at all.
Good.
And simply nothing, and she saw a movie, Davy Crockett, and she asked me about Indians and what a Tommy Hawk meant, and I had, of course, previously taught her how we are all different colors and various things like this. I think that really so much of this younger generation is getting educated, and they're knowing that by seeing other countries that our culture isn't necessarily the best.
It's hard. Because Americans have always been taught that they're, the mission idea, that they are God's chosen people.
Yeah.
And it's very hard, and it seems like we need somebody, underneath us. If it's blacks, or if it's Indians, or if it's Chicanos, if we're not so well off, but there's always somebody else who's worth it.
You know, if you read books, initially required in high school, as I was required, Hawaii and various things about our so-called great missionaries, and you find that an almost and you learn that in your horse riding, and I think you pass it on to your children, that man has made mistakes, so try not to repeat the same thing.
I think that you're talking about sort of an unusual situation, because I think the majority of people are an awful lot of the people it's like, this is our country, upbringing,
I think there are many people in education who still believe that the melting pot means have everything melt into this pot and come out the same. Instead of keeping it. There are still people in
there.
Yeah, but the melting pot really means that we're going to take everybody who's not like us and make them like us, good or wise.
That's what I mean. The melting pot
theory. Yeah, but do you think the grammar school and the junior high school side?
I'll give you an example. My wife teaches teaching the foreign languages, and in the state of Minnesota, just one example, but she kept in contact with people who were trying to do the same thing in other schools or other school systems. And they were trying to provide money to teach teachers of the Native American languages, Sioux and Chippewa, happens to be in Minnesota, so that there would be people who would teach those who they could go back to the reservation.
Yeah.
And it was Alan Speer, Lois knows, sort of a champion spokesman for all liberal causes, really, in the Minnesota State Senate, who comes from the university district, so that's the one reason that liberals, can get elected in the state legislature. If they come from the university district, all the rest are pretty, the other way. But the Spirit tried very hard, and when it came time to actually appropriating money to teach teachers of Native American languages so they could go back to the reservation, that was considered to be expendable. Because there are other things that were considered more important. So I'm not so sure that we are getting over the idea that we should be able to that we really want to have, cultural coexistence.
Yeah.
Because when it comes down to actually spending taxpayers' money, that's where where the real crunch comes in, because we can all talk about brotherhood and, cultural coexistence, isn't that nice and sweet, but when it comes down to, putting your money on the line, then, it wasn't there, which makes me sort of negative, or at least somewhat cynical. Lois?
No.
Okay.
Well, I was just going to say, too, that many times the Indians kind of believe these stereotypes of themselves too. There's a down, if you ever want to see something really horrible, go down to Wisconsin Dells sometime. They got an Indian village there.
Yeah, it's part.
And, oh boy.
You'll find Uncle Tom's. Uncle Tom's in any.
Yeah, but still, it's almost like an animal in a cage.
Yeah, oh yeah, sure. But they don't know any better. You'll find that, you know, for instance, as early as the 15th century in the slave trade, black chieftains were selling their own people to the Portuguese. But you'll find, as I say, Uncle Tom's, you know, and simply because they want, you know, whatever it is, power. In fact, the way they got the chieftains to do that was that the chieftains wanted to win their own battles against their own, you know, rivals on the Gold Coast, so the Portuguese gave them firearms and gunpowder. Well, so if that meant betraying your own people and selling them to the traders, it was worth it for them because it was that gave them more status and power. So I think you'll find, well, you know, I think we all know what I mean by Uncle Tom's, you know, in any way. And the trouble is that many whites just see the Uncle Tom's and draw the conclusions that all, you know, Indians or blacks or Chicanos, you know, yeah, like that.
More people see the Uncle Tom's as Tom Dells than the real Indians of Phenomena.
Yeah, that's tragedy, yeah. Because I've seen that thing at the Dells and all that, those stereotypes and totem poles and little played tom-toms and
where they're a big
bit. So I think that some of that goes say, you know, boy, we can build the dumb white.
Oh, sure, a lot of it, you know, beat Whitey at his own game.
Yeah, right.
No, but still, Whitey's going to get the wrong impression. That's
true.
They don't. I mean, that's a two-edged sword.
Yeah.
It's
back to the education bill. You know, there's one of the things that the Chicanos are way ahead in that treaty back in 1840, the treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo.
1848.
Okay. They finally got that one through. It granted guaranteed bicultural education, bilingual education. And it's hitting in Minneapolis, St. Paul, particularly St. Paul, because they have sort of a town of population there where they tax it, provide lab or research and stuff.
Right.
All of a sudden these things are coming in for the Chicano. And, you know, granted, okay, there's a tree there. I'm sure there's a vast in the trees that we have as England or the Native Americans didn't have any good education. And really, well, it's a broken moment. But if you can do it for the Chicanos, why can't it be there for the Native Americans?
Well, I think, frankly, the Indians are simply the this is why I think the militant movement is coming up. For so many years, the Indians have been so passive simply because it's a part of, you know, their culture. And they have been easy to cow. They have been easy to drug, really, with liquor, for instance. And the others haven't. The blacks started organizing much earlier, I suppose, as early as old Garvey and the others. They started organizing. They haven't been as easy to push around.
Oh, well, started organizing right from Nat Turner.
Yeah, well, as far as Turner, yeah.
I'd well, go. But one of the other things, though, is the blacks are much more closer to us. In as far as integration
level, they don't have an authentic, you know, native culture to go back to, where the American Indians do, and the Chicanos to a degree, much greater degree than the blacks do. That's true.
I think
so. Everything there is a sort of a dim copy, you know, of American culture, and even today the return to get back to African roots hasn't really caught on in the black population because it seems so totally remote. From it. There was some talk, you remember, in the 60s, Leroy Jones, the novelist, took on African names, and you remember Muhammad Ali and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and all the rest, but it really hasn't, you know, hasn't spread.
Yeah, but they were saying, give us a part of the United States, we'll have our own country.
Yeah. No. But, the New Africa movement, and it never really took hold. Because I think they come from an entirely different thing. I think it's primarily because the most black Americans don't want to go back to a tribal.
If they were really talking of, you know, part of this country, given was it Arizona, some say only 4 states. But one of the other things is, you know, they are a part of our culture, and I think for their own survival, it was much more expedient for them to try and get a part of our.
Yeah.
To get into our economic society would have been much easier and better and in the long run than to start out off on their own as a...
Yeah, because they didn't have any, you know, by contrast, it's a good contrast to the American, the Native Americans, they didn't have any of their own African you know, culture established here as a viable alternative, the way the American Indians
died outright.
And there was no place for you to go except back to Africa, and then you're cutting off your roots too much. You wanted to say something.
I wanted to say this, that what I have learned about the education of them now, they're teaching the Indian culture in the school and some of the other, and then they take them to Shono, to high school, and they fail.
Yeah.
Well, and they're trying to write it up that they're inferior mentally, and they are not.
That's right. That's
there are just as brilliant people that
yeah.
are as
well. Remember, when you're trying to write people inferior mentally, that's a gene that's gone
yeah.
back
mm-hmm.
to the Benin IQ test.
Yeah, right. Because IQ tests are measuring, you know, white or Caucasian IQ. That's the problem. And then people like Shockley and Jensen and the rest come along and
yeah.
say, you know, they're 15, 20 points below. Well, you know, it's an entirely different.
Sure.
Even the white IQ is working. I don't. They
yeah.
have one on CBS
yeah.
on the IQ, and they say that thing is, you know, it's how well you can read.
I know this problem, and it's a real one, and you people from Wisconsin know Artley Skenador, and we've got his son
yeah.
at St. Olaf.
Oh.
And he is a pure joy. He's a, no question, he's an all-American, red-blooded native, you know, Winnebago, and he's proud of it. And he was inside the mission during the whole January takeover, and he wrote me a paper about it. He did an independent study with me during interim. It was fascinating, you know, talking about the whole thing, and thank goodness the press never got a hold of the fact that it was, you know, the commissioner's son who was one of the militants inside, because that would have been, you know, grist for the media. But Artley is an example of somebody who got to go to the pair to a Catholic school and was prepared for college because he had this opportunity for this experience. But we tried, and we got a grant from Rockefeller to try to do something for the Sioux over at Prairie Island near Red Wing to come and again, exactly what happened. They came to college and failed, and it just made the situation all the worse. Just you know. And then you say you have a year of remedial work. Well, that
one
only
thing,
means, you know.
One
I don't know.
Thing that I found out about the Indians, and I believe it's true, certainly of the Menominee Indians, they're extremely sensitive.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well,
they are extremely sensitive. I ran into it in the classroom once in a while, just in a little slight correction, and they'd rumble it up, you
yeah.
know. And I had to get at it from another way.
Yeah, I think, you know, the idea why should, you know, because it seemed like an outsider was telling them that they are inferior.
I think
I'm sure they would respond much more affirmatively to, you know, somebody from their own group.
I think the American Indian is what is almost a perfect example of what you call cultural shock. These people were defeated over a period of Williams with the Nez Perce was about the last. They were totally, completely defeated in a military sense. Now they were some of the best fighters that ever lived in the
yeah.
world. I mean, they were just tremendous.
Yeah.
I mean, the English and French went through Africa like nobody's business, but the Indian was totally, completely defeated, and, you know, and this was a terrible thing. But then what made it worse, there's no attempt to bring them into the regular population, you know, like everyone else that came. They were set off in a cage, and whether the cage didn't have any bars around it, but they were set here in this cage and told, no, given absolutely nothing to do.
Miles from where they wanted to
go. Oh, yes, they moved them there. Well, they moved them from,
yeah.
well, they that was, that's the old Assyrian, you know, take a bunch of people from here and move them over there so they don't cause any trouble. You know?
Mm-hmm.
That's how we lost 10 tribes of Israel. But
what, you know, should we, let me get it off on a different tack. Should we try to evangelize among them as, you know, send in missionaries and try to get them away from the Sundance and the,
no.
and the you
no,
know?
I think that culture has its place. I think all these different cultures have their place, but we should work it into, like our international centers and things like that, that they have a place. Now, I think Milwaukee is, it's a long time since I was there. I think they have done a very fine job for the Menominee Indians. They had life-size figures and pictures of the Menominee leaders and different things, and I saw pictures, life-size pictures of four of my pupils when I got up there. And I thought their exhibits, their habitat groups and everything were wonderful.
Well, I see the attempt to try to reach the white population with what you might call appreciation of, you know, Native American culture. But that'd be one useful thing, but you don't think we should try to make what we'd call Protestants or Christians out of them?
Why should we be talking about doing anything for them or with them if we're also trying to get them to be the independents that they want to be?
Yeah.
We're talking here about what we want to do with them. We shouldn't be talking.
Well, I think we should let them find themselves.
We give them the reservation that he was talking about here.
Did you read the very small book? I heard the owl call my name.
Yes, I saw the movie on TV.
Oh, they made it?
They made it on the TV, right. Beautiful thing.
Do you have it here?
There is a copy. I know where I can get a copy.
It's magnificent, but the idea was for the minister to become, to help the people, he had to become one of them,
right here.
And by becoming one of them, he could then absorb their culture, absorb Christianity, and they could combine both their cultures together.
Well, he had to learn how to die, and that's why the bishop sent him to this culture. The story of it was in TV. It was actually set on location. It's very well done. Up on the British show. And set on location, and the young priest had some sort of fatal or terminal illness, and didn't know that when he was sent there. And the bishop, it was Dean Jagger who played the role, the brilliant role on TV, sent him there so that the young priest would learn how to die. And the only way he'd learn how to die would be by becoming one with the Indians, and because they had such, what should I say, this profound sense of death that was so contrary to this. But you know, we have the great, I was talking about Christianizing. We have the Great Commission about go ye and baptize everywhere.
Right. It says teach first. Go ye therefore and teach, doesn't it?
Excuse me.
Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing.
Yeah, well, baptizing isn't in the Indian. Baptism is a very specific ritual in Christianity.
But if you teach them first, maybe they'll come to Christ on their own.
I guess there was a big hassle up here a couple of years ago, too, because Carol was, as some of you know, a missionary to the Philippines and was incarcerated, I guess that's the polite word for it. Doesn't this get at the very heart of the whole thing? I mean, we don't have to make capitalists out of them or entrepreneurs or even think that we should have the right to do so. I agree, completely. I was just being the devil's advocate.
I guess our position starts, if we have to be a legalist in terms of the scriptures, with our witness in Jerusalem. It seems maybe our task is to get at the governmental structures that will allow them the opportunity where they are in pursuit of what they want.
Yes, I agree. And the, one of the real difficulties, I think is after that is, vested interests again in American life, because so many powerful interests want to protect the status quo, especially as it relates to the American Indian. And the British, if the Bureau of Indian Affairs is, I suppose, has the record of being the worst managed, most corrupt, agency in all of American history. I can tell you atrocity stories because I wrote a biography of a man who was in the BIA in 1851. Some of you from Minnesota know Governor Sibley, and I wrote my dissertation as a biography of him. And the way he took the Indians, it was just unbelievable. This is 1851. And somehow, it's never gotten there because the Indians have never, been able to fight back or never have fought back. And now, it's very difficult because so many of them have so much at stake, and the Indians don't have a lobby in Washington. And why should somebody who comes from, say, Rhode Island have a knowledge, about this? Because if he votes against, greater Indian autonomy, then somebody else will vote for a favorite bill of his. And in a way, we're caught in a political situation because they go where the greatest pressure is and where the greatest number of votes are. And here's just the largest issue. It's a case where oftentimes the majority isn't right. What do you do, in a democracy when the majority is wrong? How do you correct it? It was wrong, so many times in all of our, blacks, Indians, whatever, Chicanos, and the idea is that if it's, 51%, it's not only correct, but it's morally right. And this is a very, difficult thing to overcome, and I suppose that's one advantage of having something less than a democracy. I'm not, advocating,
I was invited into homes where there were children, at school.
Yeah.
They all wanted to meet me.
Yeah.
And they nearly always had a little present for me.
Yeah.
Probably a little piece of maple sugar that's hard, fast.
Yeah.
And I had to have something.
Yeah.
And I went to four pagan Indian funerals. Because they were my pupils. They asked me to come.
I don't know if the pagan has kind of loaded Indigenous, I think, is a better word. Indigenous native culture, I think, is a better one.
Yeah.
Because, because they might, you know, I heard.
They wouldn't like to hear pagan.
You know, and I heard a black leader in this country from Africa say, you know, talking about that, nothing could be more superstitious than, you know, the practice we have. We put flowers on our graves in our cemeteries. Well, what, you know, I mean, we know why we do it, but to somebody coming from a different, you know, a different culture, that looks just as, you know, pagan, because we're assuming that somebody is still there, and that somehow the message is going to get down there or whatever, that they know that we're honoring, you know, obviously that's not what we mean, but, you know, it's an example of...
I think somebody was talking to the Chinese and saying, why do you put food on the grave? Do you think the person's going to come up and eat it? And they said, well, I'm saying when your people are going to smell the flowers.
Smell the flowers, yeah, right. Yeah, well,
plastic flowers, Jimmy.
Yeah, I think this, you know, the real problem is the structural one here, because it's so easy to oversimplify and stereotype things, and it seems as you can make a good case that any culture needs, you know, people need, how should I say this, what I want, need people below them, inferior, in an inferior status in order to, you know, enhance their own situation. As long as the whites have had the power in this country, we've been able to do this. This is what I think scares them more than anything else, that they're going to lose this sort of thing, especially the people who live, you know, right next to the reservation, for instance, and so on. So maybe in the whole idea of equality in the United States, we've got some distance to go in the next, you know, in the foreseeable future, because what may be equal for us may not be equal for, you know, others.
Well, I think there's a great range of lack of equality in the each race.
Oh yeah, they have gradations too.
Look at these Washington Avenue people, you know.
Oh.
Look at the people that just don't want to make it.
Yeah,
and they're white.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's another. Oh, I'd forgotten old Washington. They cleaned up Washington Avenue and I'm in.
Oh, I know.
But disservice people say they don't want to make it because you are imputing something to them that you don't care.
This is a whole new ball game, folks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I couldn't let that go up because when you have people who are down and out, I think it's really, you know, and maybe people who have given up or people who've been harbored too much. But to say people who don't want to, I think is horrible judgment.
No, two little graffiti statements there. One is, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich? You know, that's part of the American dream. And the other one is that somebody said, in America, it's a sin, not just unfortunate, but it's a sin to be poor. Yeah. You're looked down on, you know, as you know, lack something, you know, as you know, the idea that if they want to be poor, let them wallow, you know.
When I was in the library, especially in the old library, we used to get these people from different places. There was one that made his own shoes. His name was Boots. Now, we called him Boots. We didn't know him by any other name. Great big fellow. And he came from a good family. There was money in the Farmers Mechanics Bank that he could have if he would change his ways.
You know, there may be dozens of reasons.
He wouldn't.
Maybe he chose. No. Well, there's nothing wrong with choosing to be poor.
He read a lot. He had quite a bit of...
Maybe he was much happier than we are. You know, look at all the executives that die of heart attacks and ulcers. You know, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you see, I'm sure, you know, at Control Data, you know, the rate of alcoholism and, you know, all the other indexes of stress. Mm-hmm. You know, if that's what you want, you know...
There's a great deal of equality in alcoholism going in. It's everybody.
Yeah, that's true.
Anybody.
Anybody. Oh, yeah, it's not just the wealthy.
Yeah.
But I'm just trying to say that there's nothing automatically, you know.
We haven't been able to solve the problems of our own race.
Yeah. That's true. Well, on that note, maybe.
You have inequality, even among the prestige kind of thing among.
These kinds of issues here are different than the one we talked about, but keep them in mind because they have to do with social equality, you know, in everyday life. And if you want to just, you know, be glad to leave
have
them
you
with
a
you.
Sheet for
sure, money? I've got anybody else who needs, I've got plenty.
Is that food meat tomorrow?
No, tomorrow, it doesn't, there's something else. I don't know
Friday?
How I got, Friday's Christmas, but Saturday we might be able to, if you want to.
Today's Wednesday.
Today's Wednesday, right. Tomorrow there's something else at 10:45.
There's something I just like, you talked to the 51%, but we've also had some pretty good...
Thank you.
Decisions by Supreme Court honoring minorities. For instance, Jehovah's Witnesses refusing to salute the flag in schools.
Yes, the Supreme Court
has ruled in some cases that
Oh, yes, not, you know, I'm trying to say, yeah, right, sometimes...
We have that tradition.
Right, oh, very much. And also, the whole, this is another two-hour discussion, the whole thing, you know, of prayers and Bible reading in schools. And there, 80% of the polls show 80% of the population wants it.
Yeah.
But my own personal feeling is, knowing what I know about the Constitution, and it's not everything, that it is unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court, just 9 men do have the right to you know, say that 80% of the public are wrong.
Right. And it can be prevented.
What about
abuse?
This woman, this atheist woman?
Oh, Madeline O'Hare?
Yeah.
Well, I think she has, you know, let her speak. Give her,
it's
you know,
free,
you bet.
Free country, you
this is really hard to... There's a kitchen up in the back of the room, back of the
dining hall
for Juanita, and you agree with...
Back of the dining hall?
Well, it's in the bulletin board just as you go out, but I have to say, you know, fine, you're all adults, but it's sponsored by an organization that's so far right that it's out of the ballpark. It's sponsored by Billy James Hargis and Christian Crusade.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you can read it up there, yeah. And I wrote a book on Hargis and McIntyre, and... read my book. Read the book.
What
was your book?
Called The Politics of Doomsday.
Who's the guy that runs the older Republican?
Billy James
Hargis
was...
Yeah,
well, there's
Armstrong.
Well, Herbert Armstrong's a whole different ballgame.
But they are still...
Oh, yeah, very right-wing politically. I mean, right-wing, I don't mind those. I mean, these guys are totalitarians.
McIntyre.
Oh, yeah, I lived with Carl McIntyre for 6 years, and that was a trip.
Oh, really? No wonder you're that way.
Thanks a lot. I'll tell you, the first time, you know, your scholar is supposed to be objective and balanced and cool. The first time I heard him, it was when the Lutheran World Federation met in Minneapolis in 57. He spoke down the old Lyceum. I threw up. That was my first reaction. That's not exactly a calm, cool, scholarly reaction, you know, to my subject.
You bet.